Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. This show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show. Today's guest is Christine Keep, Head of Technology at AcroTrend. First thing is, I want to get kind of some context on your kind of background and like why data, why so fascinated by, you know, analytics, why so fascinated by data, why, you know, where did this kind of interest come from? I mean, it's funny that, like, I was talking to someone the other day, and they were kind of talking about someone who was in like an analytics, like kind of data driven role as this like super sexy new job. Like it was a friend who just got this, you know, this new role, like a higher level role. And they were talking about it as like, it was this super sexy. And I was just like, yeah, no, that is the coolest thing ever. However, do you not think it's funny that like, it wasn't that long ago when you certainly wouldn't consider like an analytics or data role to be particularly sexy. But now it's changed. So what was it for you?
Well, my own background, my own journey into IT was erstwhile at best. My actual discipline at university and a big chunk of my early career was actually in music. So my first actual start for ten in a lot of this sort of data world was centered around musical expression. And I used to write and compose music mathematically. So music is subdivisible to 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, depending on how you write it. So there's already intrinsic maths and patterns in it. And then if you take a sort of acoustics element to it, there's things like phase cancellation and acoustic resonance and designing spaces so that they can actually capture the acoustics of the system and give it the grandeur it deserves. All of that is rooted in maths, and you don't realize you're using it. Now, the reason I'm kind of into data is actually through being interested in computers. When I was a kid, talking like seven, 8 years old, my dad would bring home old 286 laptops, these compact monstrosities. They weighed about 15 tons. They were laptop only by name. If you put them on your lap and tried to use them, you'd probably give yourself deep vein thrombosis. They're absolutely massive. But I learned BASIC through that. And again, as a language, in order to do any sort of expression within it, you have to know mathematics. There was a game on QBASIC called Gorillas, where you would type in vectors to throw bananas at another gorilla on a skyscraper. And that was one of my first sort of interactions with that thing. In order to actually get that system to work, you had to know the code to launch the programs and then move through the UI, which was rudimentary at best. So to take your point, though, about data not being a sexy industry, as it were, up until very recently, I think the help of certain terms within the week coming into sort of the common parlance, things like big data, a lot of people say it. Most people don't really know what it means. And it's not a new concept. It's been around since the days of mainframed IBMs. What's happened, though, is it's moved into the mainstream and become something that people are all of a sudden interested in. And it's always been a fascinating area. It's just now got popular leverage. There's also more data being generated now than at any point in human history. So the larger industries are realizing that all of this wealth of data that they have is suddenly a commodity. Well, the data isn't really, I suppose. The data itself is like raw material. I mean, if you were to take the analogy of data being gold, gold in itself has an intrinsic value, but only when it's either spent or crafted into something else. And that's the difference, I suppose, between data and information. And the bit that I think has got interesting is not the data itself, but the process by which you take data and turn it into something useful. The capability of systems now to process enormous amounts of information incredibly quickly by comparison, in parallel, and then even apply deep learning models like convolutional neural networks to track down unknown unknowns within systems. Something that whilst it was invented in the 80s, the hardware hasn't been around to do it until very recently. So what we're seeing is technology catching up with the maths and making some very interesting things that people like myself are incredibly attracted by.
Is it, actually there's a couple of things from that. I suppose actually just the first thing to take it back is how has the, you were talking about the popularity of it now. Like how has that changed the marketplace for the talent in the space?
Well, I can give you a perfect example. I've got a youngster working with us at the moment who's on his break for university over the summer. He's doing like a placement with us. And he is an exemplar of some of the bright sparks that I'm seeing come through the workplace at the moment. He's building apps off his own back to solve problems that are in his life. One specific app that he built was to help his grandma, who speaks Urdu, translate the labels on pill bottles and then go to the NHS API, pull data back and actually translate the responses so that she can also know what the side effects are. Now, that was just to solve a problem, and it was done very quickly. And that is what we're seeing now is that because of the tools that are available and the fact that you've got these open frameworks like Google's APIs and all the various other bits and bobs that are kicking about the market and the revolution that is Hadoop and its various cousins like Spark, Cassandra, and Flume that have made it possible for people without large amounts of capital to actually start building interesting stuff and hobbyists to really run far with it. Now, this individual is working with us as a junior data scientist because he's studying data science as his degree. And those data science really wasn't something that I used to see coming through as a graduate degree when I was earlier in my career. And I've noticed the uptake in that's a lot larger. And I think the data revolution is partly to thank for that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's particularly compelling, isn't it, that like, as you say, the popularity comes along and then all of a sudden, like, the talent comes along with it. You know, it's we see this in kind of everything. You know, I'm a big golf fan and it's the Open this week, you know. So inevitably, I'm getting ready to lose loads of money on bets. But, but you know, it was the kind of, this, you know, to draw that analogy, you know, it was when Tiger Woods came through and he was this, like, fit, athletic-looking guy. And all of a sudden, it brought, like, real athletes to the sport, and now like the standard is just incredibly high compared to what it was, you know, 10-15 years ago. So it would be exactly the same, you know, with something like this. You know, you get these incredibly talented people now who just see it as, you know, opportunity to solve problems. And what's interesting about that is I'm kind of alluding to this in a conversation not too long ago. You know, doing podcasts, you tend to have a lot of conversations, I suppose. But
I suppose it's your job, really.
Yeah. And so we were kind of alluding to the fact that, like, what is a good kind of, I think we were talking specifically about data scientists. And he was like, you know, now with the talent pool that we have, it's relatively easy to get the talent as far as like the people and the skills when they come through the door. But the difficulty is less about that now, and it's more about people understanding the problem and identifying that this is what you're working towards to try and solve the problem, or this is what the goal is, or, you know, the commercial goal that we're trying to achieve. And this is, you know, having that clarity of vision on that and not getting stuck behind the data and the numbers, you know, just for fun. So is that kind of something that, you know, you're very conscious of as well, not just yourself, but amongst your team as well? It's like, we're here at the end of the day to serve kind of, you know, corporate needs. And with all this abundance of talent and people who genuinely like it, it's sometimes it's quite easy to get off track.
I would say, certainly from my organization's perspective, AcroTrend, as we are an analytics consultancy and product development house, that's what we do. So we deal in data and data science and everything to do around that, from small scale prototyping right through to large massive integration programs that can spend multiple years. So that need for client visibility and that capability to operate within environments that aren't necessarily typical developer places to be at a client site, interacting regularly with stakeholders who you are working for, but not directly for, if you see my point. You're working with them rather than for them, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. It's those sort of soft skills and the more human side of things is something that, you know, I wouldn't expect someone fresh out of university or a graduate to have those skills. But what I tend to look for in a candidate is a bit of charisma, a bit of something about them that makes them engaging and interesting. You know, but personality is, I think, the importance of having a personality that is your own, that sets you apart from other individuals within your field, can't be understated. And I would encourage anyone who is looking, certainly at the more consultative side of things, to let that part of himself come through within any interview process. It's also something that you get better with the time. And I appreciate a younger me wasn't as confident as me that I am now is. I had to learn to do that. But I had mentorship along the way. I've been very lucky to have individuals throughout my career actually have faith in my abilities to improve and to adapt and to learn and invest that time and that money. And I believe in much the same. So to sort of round that point off, I think it's vital for someone moving into this industry who wants to differentiate themselves from those around them that they include and promote that sense of them having their own personality, the charisma that makes them who they are. Because every developer and every data scientist and every coder, full stack, front end, back end, whatever, if you're working within that consulting environment, there is the possibility and the likelihood, certainly from one's perspective, that you would be involved with interactions with a client. And having being engaging and being interesting and being able to hold a dialogue and a bit of a banter sometimes, depends on you gauge the situation as and when. It can be the differentiator between someone who's good at the job and great at their job. And I think a lot of the younger candidates that I speak to are almost afraid to show themselves, to bring themselves out in that interview scenario. And I would offer the advice, certainly for people coming to work in our sector and if they come to interview with us, to let that show, to let that shine through, because it could make the difference. If there's two people on similar skill sets and one really engages with me and makes me remember the conversation and one doesn't, there's no real sort of contest over who's going to be the one that I'm more likely to hire.
Yeah, and I think that's the importance, isn't it, of kind of extracurricular or, you know, having something else. I think it's, you know, I mean, obviously we're talking, you know, specifically around, I suppose, that the hiring and like what would be the ideal kind of person.
Absolutely.
But, you know, the importance of having outside interests, you know, and that social, like, I think it's probably massively overlooked. I think it's one of those where we kind of tick boxes. It's like, do you do something for fun? And everyone kind of writes something down. It's like, oh, you know, yeah, I go to the, you know, football or something on the weekend. But like, do you really, like, what are you engaging in outside? And I think to have that something else to kind of focus some energy on, it allows you to be adaptable, because when you're a technical person, you understand what you understand and the people around you in the office understand what you understand. But then when you're liaising with clients, as you were saying, you know, they don't always necessarily understand what you're going on about. So you can't get frustrated by that.
Yeah.
You know, you can't get frustrated. And I've seen that time and time again with, like, even, you know, in non-consultancy environments where it's just internal dynamics between teams, you know, between technical and sales or technical and marketing, et cetera. And the kind of frustration and the lack of, you know, kind of transparency or, you know, being able to put things in layman terms, it causes problems. It generally does. And I think, you know, it's getting easier and easier because I think more and more people are understanding at least like concepts behind technology. But I think, you know, it, especially in the consultancy environment, to have that understanding that not everyone gets what you get, and kind of, you know, just as an example, you know,
yeah,
is allows you to kind of do better at your job. And, you know, you inevitably also get to that place, you know, such as yourself, where you have to actually start managing people. Like, you get to that point in your career where, you know, you do have to actually consider taking on more responsibilities. And, you know, that's almost a completely different role in itself, in that you have to actually manage people now. So you have to be able to have that line of communication. And I think that's something that I think
absolutely
people want to do it forever. They have to consider that, I think.
I'd like to sort of hone in on communication specifically and say, like I said before, I don't expect anyone who's certainly new to this industry to be able to walk the walk and talk the talk straight out of the starting blocks. What I'm looking for is the potential for that capability. And, you know, you can, and the way you express that potential is by being honest with yourself that it's what you want to do, and that it's, yeah, you're happy with that level of engagement, and then letting that shine through. And I mean, one of the biggest praises I can think of for any sort of leader or manager, or in my case, sort of a functional head, is that the people you hire have the potential to do better than you do. There's no higher praise than someone, you know, even if they leave the company and they go and get an amazing job somewhere, it only reflects well on you. And I think it's important that us as leaders within these sort of sectors keep a hold of that, and that we don't develop in a cynical manner, that we try and make sure that everyone gets to the potential that they can. And everyone's potentials are different. I believe that a lot of people can do a lot of great things, and that a team of people is always more than the sum of its parts. But we have to put them in an environment that allows them to flourish, allows them to grow, allows them to be the best they can be. It's, if a flower's dying, you don't blame the flower. You change the compost. You need to give them that bedrock to build on.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I think that a lot of the time, I think people are guilty of not actually thinking, you know, long enough and hard enough about kind of others, I suppose, and you know, team dynamics and how we can improve. And, you know, I'm certainly one, and I've made it a point consistently on the podcast that it's massively overlooked, like the kind of HR function, if you like, or the, you know, whatever you want to call it, the talent engagement process, whatever fancy names people like to throw at these days. It's massively overlooked, and I think because it's difficult and it's not quite as obvious to be able to directly quantify the impact of taking the time to do things like that, you know, commercially. I think that's half the reason why it is overlooked. But I would love to see someone really put that kind of time in and be able to try and quantify the impact of, you know, reducing churn, you know, like, you know, quality of work and all these kind of things that would come along with just building that environment around things. And, you know, as people have said on this podcast, you know, I've had, you know, founders of startups several times on the show, and, you know, it's that they've said themselves, it's like, it's not ping pong tables and pool tables in the middle of the office. That's not what builds a culture, and that's not what builds like good team dynamics. It's just the interaction on a day-to-day basis, and that kind of level of comfort, and allowing people an environment where it's okay to do things wrong now and again, you know.
Absolutely. The only way you learn is by making mistakes. I've made hundreds over my career. I'll probably make hundreds more, but the only way you can do that is to make the mistake of, all right, that went wrong. Let's work out how to not do that again. And it's fine. People can't be afraid of making a mess of things, because invariably everyone makes a mess of things sometimes. I think as a culture, we put too much emphasis on failure being bad. Failure is not bad. It's a learning process. And every failure results in a success eventually, because you've just learned one way not to do this. I think it was Edison said he worked out 99 ways to invent the light bulb before he got the right one. So it's a fallacy, although I am laughing to myself a little bit. You're mentioning ping pong tables not being offices, and I'm sat in one of the meeting room looking at a ping pong table and a Time Crisis 2 arcade machine, so I can't really comment on that one myself.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest, I don't currently have that in my office, but but I have had it in the past, certainly. When I was in London, I was there was several ping pong pool tables floating about. You know, it was past the time, I suppose. But you
also mentioned about churn rates, and that wonderfully brings us back in a full loop to the original topic of this, which is data. And certainly some of the things that we've been working on with our clients revolve around churn. It may not be the actual employees within a company. It could be customers. It could be a myriad different other things. But that data-driven approach can also be used to help with churn of employees. You assess why they're churning. You statistically model a mechanism by which you put these as parameters into the model and work out what the likelihood of churn is based on these different parameters over a period of time. There's no reason why we can't do that. And I know some HR analytics firms already do these sort of things. So there are ways of using data to try and make the workplace a better place for everyone involved.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. Always thinking that way, Christian. It's you know, I like that a lot. I like that a lot.
always a day geek, my friend.
Yeah, no, well, I love it too. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, if anything that can be kind of, you know, quantified is better, in my opinion. You know, that's coming from a lean startup background. So, like, I had no choice in the matter. It was kind of be lean and efficient and make everything a number and a probability and percentage play. So it can be applied. I think it's kind of one of those things where it's just not come to the masses yet. It's not been a popular trend that people are invested in. But I think I've said this before. I think that all it takes is one company to kind of explode in growth and then to turn around and acknowledge that, you know, this kind of, you know, HR analytics was a huge part of that before everyone jumps on the bandwagon. So I think it's inevitably going to happen. I think it's just not come to the masses yet. But, you know, I think that it will do. And I think it has a lot to do with leadership and stuff like that as well. It's like, you know, what background are they from? You know, typically, I suppose, like MDs, CEOs are probably from sales, marketing backgrounds.
Not necessarily. For example, the managing director for this company, Sandy Mandarata, is an ex-consultant from Deloitte. He's come from that background. There are CEOs I've met who are former engineers, and the engineering mindset is built around process and mechanism and cause and effect and one thing after another. I know scientists for life science organizations over in the US who have got PhDs in biochemistry, but now they're existing in a completely different world. But it always has the context of their core competency, which is why I suppose I work for a technology company, because technology is my core competency. I just happen to do the strategic side of it as well. But the opportunities are out there. I mean, ourselves, we're going through a period of growth right now following the spinning up of new products that we're actually developing. And we've had to onboard quite dramatically as a result, just to get us the amount of people we need. And that's taken on a myriad of different forms. It's taken on the form of freelancers in some cases, contractors in others. We've been reskilling our own staff so that they're able to keep up with the newest technologies. It's something I believe in really, really strongly. We're looking at new hires, both in the UK and abroad. We have a center in Mumbai. We're hiring there as well. We're looking at setting up other offices if that is advantageous to our cause. It's a really quite an exciting time for us, and it all revolves around the fact that data is everyone's business now. I mean, I think it was the CEO of Tesco who said that if you do analytics well, you too can get a knighthood. And if that's not sort of an incentive enough to actually chase this, I don't know what is.
Yeah, well, he's probably got a point, I think. I want to talk about like next now. I know that as your interests, data, like you're in an ideal space at the moment, because I think the innovation at the moment is coming from the data space as far as what's going to be kind of the most applicable and realistic, I think. And there's other things that are coming on, you know, but I think that in this space, it's kind of the most applicable and realistic to in the mid to short term that we're going to see it impact dramatically. AI obviously being one of the big ones. You know, I think that for me, it's massively exciting. I think that it is going to have kind of a massive shift in kind of industry, I think, when it's kind of applied. I think, you know, we're even looking at kind of, you know, robots and all the other kind of thing that people have probably irrational fears about. But, you know, when you look at it, someone who's kind of, you know, it involved on a day-to-day basis, when you look at it, what do you kind of think? Do you think it looks like a prosperous future with these new technologies? Are you bullish, bearish? How do you kind of feel about it?
I'm definitely a futurist at heart. I think that no challenges that humanity face cannot be overcome with our ability to innovate and collaborate. You know, because we, when we're working in consult, can do amazing things. And that has been a core part of my belief structure for probably most of my life. It's why I gravitate towards sectors where there's that potential for something truly amazing to happen. I'm also a massive sci-fi nut, so of course AI was going to be on the horizon for something I'd love. But to zone in on AI and its various cousins like machine learning and natural language processing and neural networks, or is also known as deep learning, these are wonderfully exciting places to operate. And I think what we're going to see is that certainly the world of analytics and data is going to become, or is becoming even, I think we're already on that journey, synonymous with AI. The two will be inseparable. And our everyday options and processes and the way that we operate will change as a result. And we won't even realize it's doing it for a lot of the time. It'll just happen in the background, underneath the hood of everything we're using. Everything will get smarter. It'll get adaptive. And I think certainly for us as real lovers of data and the way that it can make a massive difference in the world, it's an exciting time to be working in this industry.
Yeah, there's no question. There's absolutely no question. And do you think that when you look at things like, you know, blockchain something similar to what IoT are doing with this like kind of blockchain technology and things like that, do you think that like all this stuff is there and even the hardware is relatively close to where that would be as well?
People talk about blockchain like it's been an invention that's come out of nowhere. It's been around for quite a while. It was part. It's the core of the Bitcoin technology, and that's been around a fair while now. In fact, I actually went to school with one of the creators of Bitcoin, which was an interesting segue I found out. But I think consensus-modeled systems like that, which are decentralized, they're going to revolutionize banking in a big way. It may not make all the big players particularly happy about it because it gives them potential for their monopoly hold on some things to go. But I think with any industry, we saw this with the likes of Blockbuster and Netflix, in order to stay relevant, you have to innovate and adapt and move with the times. So I know and I see banking particularly plowing a lot of money into blockchain because they see it as the next step along their evolution. And they know that if they don't, there's the potential to be left behind.
Yeah. Well, I think that's like you say, because of Bitcoin and all the other kind of cryptocurrencies and stuff. Yeah. That's the obvious banking one. You know, I spoke with a founder of a blockchain company called BigChain, I believe it's called. Based in Berlin. Yeah, I had the founder on the podcast not too long ago, and you know, super smart guy, of course. And you know, I think there's still a lot of skeptics out there about that, the actual application. And one of the things that he was talking about, and kind of this was my layman take from it, was that like the idea of like a decentralized internet, for example, was the actual same concept that the actual internet had in the first place. It's just that some things got so popular that they didn't realize they were going to get that way that it became centralized again. So it was an interesting one. And then I was kind of asking about, like, you know, obviously the application of, like, you know, even things like cars, you know, how do you apply this technology to, you know, the Internet of Things and such thing. So I think the prospects there, I don't know how soon something like that's going to come along and, you know, whether what your kind of thoughts are on it, because obviously he was incredibly, you know, bullish on the idea. Of course, he built a company around it, but but you know, there's still a lot of kind of skeptics out there around the matter. Where do you kind of stand on it?
I would say that, you know, 5-10 years ago, there was a lot of skeptics around AI and machine learning. Even less than that, there was a lot of skeptics around the Alexa and the Echo Dot project before that came out. And they've both done phenomenally well. I've got an Echo at home. I think it's brilliant. We've even built a few skills just to demonstrate some of the capabilities. It's a wonderful bit of tech. But you tell me a couple of years ago that Amazon were going to build that, I don't think a lot of people would have given it the time, well, as much time of day as it has now. And it's always the case when you've got new methods of working is that it doesn't, we as humans are naturally averse to change. We see, I think, from our reptilian brain, a change of status quo is almost like a threat. It's we know a situation, we understand how a situation works. If it changes, we suddenly don't understand that, so we don't know where the dangers are. That's built into our hindbrain, and it's something that we have to learn to overcome. And I think those who are willing to put that in their back pocket and pay it no mind to a certain degree and move forward and at least experiment, they can fail or they can succeed. And if they fail, at least they tried and they know not to try it again. But if they succeed, the payoffs can be amazing.
Yeah. I just think there's a healthy way of thinking in general. But yeah, I think that, you know, specifically talking about these kind of projects, I think I don't think there's too much room for skeptics anymore. I think it's almost here, isn't it? And
yeah,
and it's going to change, I think, the workforce quite dramatically, which I think is where most of the skepticism comes from. But I always say that, you know, we've been through something like that before with, you know, the Industrial Revolution. So it's like people just have to reskill, you know, adapt, right, I suppose. And I think forward-thinking people like yourself aren't fazed by that, but I think some people probably are. And I think it's going to affect – my only thing is I think that it will affect more things than we kind of consider, even down to, I think, something, you know, education. And I've been, again, pretty vocal on, I think, that the education space is just dying for someone to disrupt it, you know, in a massive way. I think that technologies like this will inevitably do so. You know, we're teaching things that aren't even up to date now in schools. So, like, when this comes along, like, I mean, it's going to be such a dinosaur, and, you know, and overpriced and all the rest of it, that, you know, that's things like education and, you know, everything. It's just going to be totally, totally disrupted. And I like that. I think disruption's sexy, as they say.
Well, from the startup space, you would say that. But it's a point that I share. I do think change for the better is important, but sometimes you got to try a change that makes things worse to know that that's not how you do it to make it better. You know, it's success isn't necessarily a one route to it, and you will try things, and some will succeed and others will fail, and the ones that succeed, you take them forward. Now, to go to your point around changing nature of jobs, you're right, and I think we as a society, not just as a company or as a even like a council or anything, on a societal level, we have to consider how we make sure that nobody gets left behind. I think that goes without saying. I don't necessarily. I think that's something we need to work out how we do that and what the nature of new jobs are going to look like. But the work is still there. The machines that we're building need to be operated on, need to be maintained. And yes, even while they're self-learning, they're very specific in their intent. The idea of general AI that can do everything for all things is miles off. The idea of the thinking machine that's going to go full Skynet on us and eradicate humanity is miles off. But it's the fear around it, it needs to be tempered by understanding. And fear is an expression of you know, not understanding. Well, not understanding is the wrong word of saying it. It's not the case not being presented well enough as to why this is important and why you should care about it. And the changing nature of work and the changing nature of jobs is something that will happen. It will happen overnight. It'll happen slowly. It'll probably happen gently. We as a culture are quite slow to change anyway. We don't do anything on a knee jerk. So I'd say a lot of the fears around jobs being yanked from under people are unwarranted. But we need to make sure that as those industries transition into something smarter from a technological perspective and more automated and will require a different type of work to keep them maintained, that we make sure that we bring people along for the ride.
I like that. I like that a lot. I couldn't agree more. I'm conscious of time, so I think I haven't actually asked this in a while, but it's always quite something that I'm always curious to, and there's always a different answer to. But when you look back at, you know, your career, you know, and you think about the achievements that you've had, you know, or you hope to have had at that point, what for you, you know, would satisfy you and think, you know what, I did all right there?
I know, I take your point. Well, my career, it's almost had two different types to it. It's got the career before and after IT, but I'm going to focus on the one, the after IT, as it were, or within IT, I should say, is the best way to describe it. And my own sort of journey to where I am now was actually facilitated through having to move to London because my wife got a scholarship for the Royal Academy of Music to do a master's degree. So we moved down so that she could study. And at that point, I took the opportunity to switch from being a pure play technologist. I was a senior BI developer at the time, to become an actual business consultant with a consultancy company. Now, I'd never really been, I'd operated without realizing it as a consultant within the organizations I've worked for already. I just didn't have a name for it. So turning that into the job that I actually had at the time felt a bit scary, but I joined and it proved to be one of the biggest learning experiences of my life. So whilst it's hard to say what I would consider the most thing I'm proud of, because at the moment every day we're doing something new, and what I would say is I'm proud of now will be maybe different tomorrow. So it's a constantly moving goalpost. But what I would say is one of the best decisions I made was to follow my wife down to London and take up the consultancy track, because I learned more from doing that than I've ever learned at any point in my career.
I like that. It's always the unexpected that we
absolutely
we learn from. Yeah,
and I think that's the point I take, is that be willing to embrace the unknown, be willing to take on the unexpected, and see where it lands you, because uncertainty shouldn't be something that's frowned upon. In fact, personally, I thrive on it. The ambiguity is great, because in ambiguity, there's great opportunity to do something really, really interesting and really cool, because the boundaries aren't set. You've got room to maneuver, room to breathe, and you can come up with some really interesting stuff.
I like that. Christian, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. Thank you for taking the time today.
Not a problem, mate. Absolutely fine.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website venturi-group.com, and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.